Good to see all of you here. I appreciate very much your presence. I know there are a lot of things that you could be doing other than being here, but I think you've chosen wisely. As I think back, he was talking about the purpose of gospel meetings, and I go and I travel different places to preach, and the intent is to help you, but oftentimes I find that I'm the one that benefits from the time. You get to go all over the world or the country and meet people, and they're your brethren, and you've never met them before, but it's like you're home. And that's really a neat thing. I will say this, though. Sometimes there's an art to complimenting people. Are you aware of that? Not everybody's really good at that. I was preaching at a place one time, and I got finished with my sermon. I was preaching on hell. And the lady came and met me at the door, and she said, "Steve, I want you to know, I didn't know what hell was like until I heard you preach." I'm still wondering about that. I don't know if that's a compliment or an insult, but you all have been kind. And yesterday, I appreciate all the kind remarks from the lessons that we shared yesterday. And I'll try to not make you struggle as you listen tonight. The story is told of Sherlock Holmes and his companion Watson. They went out camping one night. It was, 3 o'clock in the morning. And Holmes is in a sleeping bag, and he punches Watson next to him, and he says, "Watson, look up and tell me what you see." Well, Watson knows how astute Holmes is, and he wants to impress him. And so he says, "Well, I see thousands of stars." And Holmes said, "Yes, but what does that mean to you?" And so he thought for a second, and he said, "Well, to me, I guess it means that of all the creation of God, we are most blessed. We're given the ability to appreciate beauty and to reason and to have this intellect. And I can sit here as an observer, an intelligent observer of this universe, and I see the vastness of God's handiwork." He was really proud of his answer. Didn't think Holmes could top that. So he said, "So Holmes, what does it mean to you?" And Holmes said, "Well, to me, it means that while we were asleep, someone stole our tent." Two very different perspectives, right? I mean, Watson's looking way off in the universe, and Holmes is thinking we wouldn't be looking at that if somebody hadn't stolen our tent much closer to home. And if you can understand that, then maybe you can understand our dilemma in our culture today. Because, you know, while we have been asleep, someone has stolen our tent. Our tent of moral objectivity. Our tent of being able to just look at something and analyze it and say, "That's wrong. That's not right." Just about everything that we would point to today as children of God and say, "The Bible says that's wrong," you're going to have somebody in our society say, "No, it isn't. You're wrong for saying it's wrong." Excuse me. And so that's what I want us to talk about tonight. I want us to get our eyes out of the stars and our mind out of the stars and get back a little closer to home. It is amazing where we are today. Just the other night, my mom is 83 years old and lives in West Virginia. And my daughter and I got on our phones and we're talking to each other Jetson style. You know, you remember the cartoon, the Jetsons? Who would have thought you could ever see someone you're talking to? Well, we do it, you know, and it's amazing. And you know, I've got friends that are doctors, and they can split your chest open and pull your ribs apart and take your heart out and hold it in their hands and put it back, and you're better for it. Imagine that. And just all the things, there are so many things that we have been able to accomplish, and it's hard not to get caught up in, "Wow, look what we've done." But while we've been doing those things, something much closer to home has been stolen from us, and it's our morals. We don't know up from down anymore. We don't know right from wrong anymore. Isaiah said it this way, there would be a time that would come when people would say, good is evil and evil is good. Hey, that day's here. We're living in that kind of a culture. And you may get by for a while with that kind of confusion, but eventually, when the storms of life come, you're going to need shelter. You know, you're out in the woods and someone steals your tent. You may make it a couple nights, but eventually you're going to need some shelter. And the same is true with us as we try to walk our lives and live holy lives. If we don't have the shelter of God's word and the objective truths that it teaches, eventually we're going to find out, now what do we do? And so here's what I want us to do tonight. I want us to identify how we've gotten where we are and how we can get back to where we should be. And then the lesson will be yours. But we are in a mess today. Well, Dr. Alan Bloom wrote a book back in the 90s called The Closing of the American Mind. He was a professor at Chicago University, and he wrote this book. Probably many of you have read it, or maybe some of you have. But in this book, he said, you know, there's one absolute truth that when these freshmen come to college, they're all in agreement about this one thing. And you know what that one thing they're all in agreement on? There's no such thing as absolute truth. You know, you kind of want to say, are you sure about that? Because that would, if they said they were, then they deny what they affirm. But we have a generation of people that don't believe that there's any definite right or wrong. And that's the way everybody thinks about it. So how have we gotten there? That's why we're debating things such as, you know, are we going to have men going in women's restrooms and women going in men's restrooms? And are we going to have abortion or not? And all these moral issues are because we can't say definitively, this is right and this is wrong. That's part of our problem. But how have we gotten there? Because we haven't always been there. As a nation, how did we get here? Let me give you 3 points that I believe that have helped us get to where we are today. And number one is we've removed God from our thoughts. We don't want to think about God. We don't want to acknowledge God in anything that goes on in our lives. And consequently, well, if you never bring God into a conversation, if you never teach anybody about God, pretty soon they begin to live like animals. And that's where we are. The Bible tells us in Romans chapter 1 and verse 28, and I think it's really interesting the way it's put. But he said that, they're without excuse. He talks about people who were sinners in the first century, the Gentiles in particular. And he says they're without excuse because there's been enough revealed about God to convince anybody that he exists. But here's what he says about them in verse 28. And they didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. It's not that they didn't know there was a God. They don't like to think about God. And so they push him out of their mind. Listen, if you guys want to do this religion thing, okay, go ahead and do it. But just keep it in the building, all right? You know, keep your religion to yourself. If you want to waste a Sunday and come to a building and do your thing, well, do your thing. But don't take it to the workplace. Don't take it to the marketplace of ideas. Just do it in your building, and I won't have any problem with you. That's where we are. We don't want to talk about God. We don't want to talk about God in schools. We don't want to talk about God at work. We don't want to talk about God in any forum. And then we're surprised that we don't respect human life today. If there is no God, if I bought into this lie that says there is no God, then tell me, if we are the product of blind chance, what morally would be different that if there was a bug across here, I smashed it and smashed you? What would be the moral difference? If we're all here just by chance and we have no purpose and we have no aim beyond this life, then who's to say that action's wrong? There's no moral standard. I mean, why would I be governed by yours? You might say, I don't like that. Well, so? What does how you feel have anything to do with how I feel? If there is no God, there is no absolute truth. If there is no absolute truth, then everything's up for grabs. We become our own gods and decide our own morals, and that's where we are. I talked to a guy once who was a member of the church. He was unfaithful, and his mother asked me to go talk to him and try to reason with him. And I talked to him, and he said, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any absolute truth. Everything's relative. And I said, I don't really think you believe that. And he said, yeah, I do. And I said, what about the Holocaust? Were the Nazis evil in putting to death over 6 million Jews, just exterminating them? Any man, any sane man would say, of course that was wicked. But he wouldn't say it. He had to not say it to be consistent. Because he knew if he said, that's wicked, then I would follow and say, says who? And then you get into God. And so he would rather be consistent and say, nope, I can't even say that what they did was wicked. But that's where we are as a society. A few years ago, there was a judge in Louisiana who had ruled that there was an abstinence-based sex education course that was taking place in their school system. And the judge said, you can't teach that. And the basis for his ruling was this. Abstinence is a religiously based virtue, and it has no place in school. Oh, really? Well, what about not cheating? What about not beating up the person sitting next to you in the chair? What about, lying and stealing and all of those things? Those are religiously based virtues as well, are they not? Just because something keeps company with religion doesn't mean it's off limits. But that's how far we've gone in our culture to remove God from everything. If we look at Judges chapter 2 and verse 10, there was a period of time when the Israelites, well, they had some great judges, some good men. Leaders, Joshua, Moses, brought them over into the promised land. And then there's a statement that was made, when they died, when that generation died, their children didn't know God, nor did they know the power of God. In other words, mom and dad didn't even teach their children about the God who delivered them from Egyptian bondage. They didn't know the stories about the Red Sea parting. They didn't know the stories about the 10 plagues. They didn't know the stories about how God had delivered them and brought them out. They were ignorant of God and His power. No wonder they digress so far in the book of Judges. But how do moms and dads not instill a knowledge of God in their children? That's where we are. A member of the church, a friend of mine, went to visit his sister, and she had a son who was about 10 or 12 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood. And this man, who's my friend, was having breakfast with his nephew, and they were talking, and something came up, and he said something about Jonah, and the boy said, who? He said, Jonah, you know, Jonah and the whale. Jonah and the whale. What are you talking about? He said, you don't know the Bible story about Jonah getting swallowed by a fish? And he said, never heard it. This boy went to church. His mother was a Christian. And he had no earthly idea of what that story was all about. Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 4, going through verse 9. Well, let me just go ahead and turn there and read, because I want you to see a couple things that I think are interesting. Moses said, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and your gates. Do you get the idea that God wanted them to remember what he had to say? Sure do. When we were living in Kentucky, we bought a house from a Jew. And he would drive to Nashville. There was no synagogue in our town, but he would drive to Nashville to attend a synagogue. But we bought his house. And when we bought his house, he had a little box. Do you know what a mezuzah is? It's a little box that you put on your doorpost, and it's right at eye level for most normal people. It was a little low for me. But it had a little door on it, a little metal box, and you open the door, and inside of it were Ten Commandments. And so every time you went in and out of your house, you were reminded of the Ten Commandments. A few years ago, right before we moved to Carnes, Kim sent me for our 25th wedding anniversary. She sent me to Israel, and I got to go and do that. We used to joke. I said I would tell people for our 25th wedding anniversary, what are you going to do for your wife? And I'd say, I'm going to send her to Hawaii. And he goes, wow. People would say, wow, that's really neat. How are you going to top that for your 50th? And I would say, I'm going to go back and get her. And, I'm sorry, that's ugly. But here's what happened. She sent me to Israel. I had to check the tickets and see if it was round trip. But on the way over there, there were all kinds of Jews. I was miserable on this plane. It was such a long flight, and I was just standing at 4 o'clock in the morning in the aisle. Everybody's asleep, and I'm just standing there because I couldn't sit. And all of a sudden, all these Jewish men wake up at the same their hand, and then they took this thing, and they had this box sitting right in front of their eyes, and they were doing exactly what this text, in a very literal way. They bound the commandments on their arms, and they put it between their eyes. Are we teaching our children diligently that there is a God? How do you look outside? Did you see the moon tonight? Did you not go, wow, that is cool? And it is. How can you look up into the heavens and say, there is no God? That's the purpose of the heavens. To look up, it declares the glory of God. But one of the reasons why we are where we are today is because we've raised a generation of children that don't know anything about God. We don't acknowledge him in our ways. We don't acknowledge him. There was another judge who ruled on, there was a case where a man had raped a 12-year-old girl. And he was brought before the judge in the state of Louisiana. And the man was found guilty. And in the sentencing of that man, the judge was infuriated at his actions. And he quoted the Bible in his sentencing. And a mistrial was declared because he quoted the Bible. That's how ridiculous we have gotten by trying to remove God from our thoughts. That's one of the reasons we are where we are. Here's another reason we are where we are. Number two, pleasure has become our God. If you don't have God in your life, well, you're going to have to replace it with something, because there's that God-shaped compartment that has to get filled with something in our souls. And if we're going to deny that the God of the Bible is God, well, then we're going to fill it with something else, and it's going to be our God. And what we have chosen in our culture is entertainment, pleasure. Paul described people like that in his day, Philippians 3 and verse 19. Do you remember what he said? He said, their God is their belly, fulfillment, satisfaction. That's all they live for. And man, does that not describe us today? Just let me be happy. Let me be fulfilled. Let me have satisfaction. And that's the rule of life. They seek it. That's what they live for. Well, it's called hedonism. I know we don't necessarily use that word often, but hedonism is just this. It's a philosophy of life that says, if something brings you pleasure, it's good. And if it brings you pain, it's not good. And that sounds like, well, that's pretty easy. That'd be a pretty good, easy to follow philosophy. If it makes me happy, it's good. If it doesn't, it's bad. But that's one of the most bankrupt, morally bankrupt philosophies that a person could ever live by. And yet we're living by it. And it's not just the world that is living by that. It's members of the church have bought into this philosophy. Have you ever wondered how people can go to bed at night and pillow their head and go to sleep after what they've done that day? How can they do that and not be bothered by their conscience? And we look at this and think, you know, some of the most heinous things are done. And we say, how in the world can people do that? And they're fine with it because they live by a different standard. They're not answering to God. They're answering to themselves. And if it makes them happy, it's good. They haven't done anything wrong. But I'll show you how bad this can be. Kim and I went to a young couple's party one night. And there were about 20 of us there at a member's house. And we were playing during the course of the night this game, like the newlywed game. How many of you remember the first time you met your spouse and see if you could match up questions and all that kind of stuff? And there was this one couple there, and they were just like over the top, lovey-dovey, yuck kind of stuff. I mean, it was like, oh, man, this was just... And they were just, oh, the first time I saw him, and just all that kind of stuff. And when we left that night, Kim and I were talking in the car. We said, can you believe this couple, the way they were talking and everything? The next morning was church morning. And I saw the man at church, and he brought his two boys. And his wife wasn't there. And we went out to eat afterwards. And I got a phone call while we were out to eat. And the man called and said, Steve, my wife's gone. I don't know where she is. I don't know what's happened. All of her stuff is gone. She had moved out. And for 2 weeks, he didn't know if she was alive, kidnapped, whatever. He never had any communication. This woman has two preteen boys that she has abandoned. For 2 weeks, they had no idea if she was alive or dead or what. And finally, she called home and she said, I just want you to know, I'm living with another man who happened to be married, and she is making a life with him. And eventually, I talked to her on the phone, and I said, she said, I'm going to marry this guy. And I said, well, Debbie, you can't do that. You've been in church all your life. You know what the Bible teaches. And I began to quote Matthew 19:9 to her. If a man shall put away his wife except for fornication and marry another, he commits adultery. And as I was in the middle of that verse, she just stopped me. She said, Steve, stop. I don't want to hear any more. And this is what she said. I don't care what that verse says. This man makes me happy. You see, that's hedonism. And it came from a church member. What she was saying is that if I can be happy, I'm good with leaving my kids. I can abandon my children. I can leave my husband behind because I'm happy and that's all that matters in life to me. Those attitudes prevail in our culture. There was a girl in one of the congregations where I worked. When she was young, she was never disciplined. It was the kind of child that when you would watch, you would say, boy, if I had that child for 5 minutes, I'm telling you, you know, it was one of those kind of things. And this, she was a girl, and never disciplined. And everybody was saying, boy, they're going to have trouble. And they did. The mother came to me when she was 12 years old, and she said, Steve, I don't know what to do. This girl's a mess, out of control. She beat her father up. She was a big girl. Her father was a little guy, and she literally beat him up at the age of 12. And mama's in my office saying, tell me what to do. I wanted to say what you should do should have been done 12 years ago. But, you know, and so what are you to do? Well, when that girl turned 16, she and a couple friends, she's a member of the church, she and a couple friends went out driving around one night, saw a girl from school that they kind of knew, they recognized her from school, they asked her if she wanted a ride, she got in a car, they drove out in the woods, stopped the car on a dirt road, got in the back and opened the trunk and got a baseball bat, and they each took turns hitting that girl in the head with a baseball bat. They murdered her. They went back to school the next day, and they were bragging about it. It wasn't hard to make the arrest because they didn't keep it quiet or anything. And they cut a deal with that girl and asked, if you will tell us why and all the details, we'll go lighter on you. And she cut that deal with the prosecutor. And when the trial came and they asked her, why did you take this girl that you didn't even know and do this to her? You know what her answer was? We thought it'd be fun to watch somebody die. That was the reason. And that was justification enough. We thought it would be fun. And anything's justifiable if it's fun, if it brings you pleasure. Under this system of hedonism, that's where we are today. That's why we are. That's why guys can do things and you see on the news and you think, how in the world can people do that to each other? It's because they're living by a different standard than you are. They got rid of God. And in their place, they have put pleasure. And that's what they live for. And if anything, even if it's depraved and twisted, if it brings them pleasure, then it's okay. They don't have a guilty conscience because to them they've done the right thing. And then here's the third thing that has helped to get us where we are today. And it's this, that we have defined down deviancy. What do I mean by that? Well, here's maybe this is the way I can best illustrate it. I grew up in West Virginia. My grandma and granddad King, my mom's parents, they lived in a little town called Reeder, West Virginia, out in the middle of the mountains. And when we would go visit grandma and granddad, you couldn't just go in and entertain yourself with the TV. You know, that's what we do at home. But when we went there, you didn't just go in and turn the TV on because granddad'd say, what are you doing that for? And we'd say, watch it. Well, what are you wanting to watch? And if we didn't have an answer, he'd say, you're not going to just waste your time doing that. Go outside and play or do something. But there had to be a purpose. I'm telling you, if we put a 2016 television in my grandma and granddad's house with the programming of 2016, that thing would be on the front porch waiting for somebody to pick it up. They wouldn't have stood for it. Kim and I once went to Nashville and we heard a preacher talking about his television. And he said, it's, you know, in the corner of the house like everybody else's, but it always brings up discussion because it's turned around backwards. And he said, whenever anybody comes in the house, they say, TV on the blink? No. You've been working on it? No. And eventually they get around to, well, why is it backwards in the corner of the house? And he said, well, if my children behave like that thing behaves, I'd stand them in the corner. So, you know, he put his TV in the corner. Maybe that's an extreme, but it does make a point, doesn't it? Of all places, our home should be a safe haven from the world. And yet we invite every kind of trash and filth into our homes through that television set. We have defined down deviancy. It's been just a piece at a time. It would be a shock to our system. What was it, 1941 or 1946, somewhere around in there, Gone with the Wind has one curse word in it, and it shocks the nation. If we had a movie with one curse word in it today, it would shock the nation for different reasons. Can you believe that? There was only one curse word in that movie. We use euphemisms today. And I would encourage you not to do that, because all we do is we aid and abet by using euphemisms. Let's call sin, sin. You know, a number of years ago, there was a woman on the Phil Donahue show. I remember watching it. She'd been married like 8 times, was living with a guy. And Donahue said, "You still committing fornication with so-and-so?" And she said, "What?" He said, "You know, fornication, the Bible, fornication." Oh, she went, well, I don't like to call it that. Well, I don't suppose she did. But that's exactly what it was. We today, we call abortion, we call it the murder of babies. We call it the right to choose. Boy, that's a whole lot easier to say, isn't it, than baby killer. We talk about suicide, dying with dignity. That's much more palatable. We call homosexuality gay. You talk about the ruination of a good word. There's nothing gay about it. Why accommodate them that? Why would we take something that says this is an abomination in the eyes of God, and we twist it, and we accommodate people in their twisting it, and we call it gay? There's nothing gay about it. We call adultery affairs. We call fornication love. And the list goes on. We call lying misinformation. And I can just keep going with these softened words to describe our actions, because we're a little bit guilty of committing them. We need to call things what they are. They're sin. And I don't want to talk about sin in a way that lessens the guilt of someone who's committing it. I want them to feel what God expects them to feel, that guilt that they should experience. We have found ourselves in a mess. Our morals have been stolen from us. And we better do our best to get them back. How do we get them back? Let me give you 3 things, and I'll just tell you real quickly. Number one, we need to embrace the Christian ethic ourselves. We got to start doing right. Somewhere, along the way, we've got to dig our heels in and say, "No. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. I don't care if the youth group's going. I don't care if everybody at church has seen it. We're not going to do it because it doesn't honor God. And I don't believe that Jesus would go or sit or watch or say or do whatever it is under consideration. We're not doing it." Someone has to have the courage to say, "Enough." That's how we stop. It's one person, one family, one church, one community at a time. Then we have to proclaim what we have now embraced. And don't get that mixed up. Don't go out and proclaim it if you're not going to live it, because that's hypocrisy and that turns people off. You accept the standard of God, you embrace it, and then go out and teach it. Encourage your neighbors to do likewise. And then here's the third thing. Pray. Intercession on behalf of our nation. You know, if Abraham would have had a few people to pray, if there were more people that were righteous, that cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and the plains would have been saved. What a difference we can make if we as children of God would lift our voices up to God and pray for our nation. Man, we have a lot to say about politics, don't we? And we've just been through a whirlwind of an election. And I've heard barbs thrown every direction at everybody. And, you know, there's a lot of fault and blame to be laid at the feet of individuals. But here's the thing. While we're doing all that, has anyone ever thought to pray? You know, I'm vocal, but have you prayed? We need to pray. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, James says. We need to be about that. And we need to pray in a way that allows God to do what He wants to do the way He wants to do it. And that might mean I lose some of my freedoms. It might mean I lose some of my retirement. Do you love morality enough to say, God, if it means that I'm not retiring as wealthy as I would have otherwise, it's okay. If you can just bring us back to You as a nation, I'm good with that. Do you have the nerve to pray that prayer? God, do whatever it takes to bring us back. That's what we need to do to fix it. Listen, folks, the American family, we're not very well today. We're sick. And I think the reason is because of the things that we talked about. We have defined down deviancy. We've taken God out of our life and we've replaced it with pleasure. And it hasn't served us well. But there's hope. Because the Bible tells us of a great physician, and He can make a difference. He can make us well again. I don't quote Ted Koppel. But he did say something at a commencement address a number of years ago that I thought was insightful. And I want to read and close with this command or this statement that he made to these graduating seniors from college. He said, "We're not going to change what's wrong with our culture through legislation or by choosing up sides on the basis of popularity or party affiliation. We're going to change it by small acts of courage and kindness, by recognizing each of us, her own obligation to set a proper example. Aspire to decency. Practice civility toward one another. Admire and emulate ethical behavior wherever you find it. Apply a rigid standard of morality to your lives. And if periodically you fail, and you surely will, adjust your lives, not the standards. There's no mystery here. You know what to do. Now just go out and do it." And I think that's good advice. And I'm going to close with the same words. God has called us to a high and holy standard. And we're not going to attain to it perfectly. We're going to make mistakes along the way. But don't let your mistakes cause you to pull the bar lower to make you feel better. Keep the bar where God put it and aspire to it. And if we'll do that, we'll be a better person and we'll influence other people to be better people because they're in our presence. We've got work to do. Listen, the church, if there was ever a time, the church really needs to be the church right now. The world is lost and they're groping in darkness and they don't know how to find the way out. We do. We've found the way out. We've got to do our job. We've got to quit being like the world and live a holy life. That passage that the young man read at the beginning of services, Hebrews 12 and verse 14, it says we're to pursue peace and holiness. And listen, without which you will not see God. We've got to be holy people if we want to see God. Let's live holy lives. Let's help others to see the benefits of that kind of a lifestyle. If you're here tonight and you're not yet a child of God and you still have sin in your life and you want to be holy, then do what Jesus said. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Do you want to be saved from your sins? Do what He says. He's faithful. If you're a child of God already but unfaithful, and maybe you say, you look at your life and you say, you know, I've just kind of been coasting, and I want to do better, and I want my brethren to know and to help me do better by praying for me. If that's your case, come forward as we stand together and sing.